Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
If you're listening to this broadcast on medium or shortwave in Europe or America, then this announcement is for you. As of July 1st, our programs will no longer be broadcast in these areas and on these frequencies, but they will still be available via satellite, on the internet, on demand and in podcast, and on local radio stations that rebroadcast them. For details, visit our website at vaticanradio.va.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments. As the Year of Faith is launched in the Vatican's press office, we speak to the Undersecretary of the Pontifical Council for Promoting the New Evangelization, Monsignor Graham Bell. We try to better understand what new evangelization means at a parish level with Monsignor Peter Fleetwood. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. I'm about to bring you an interview with the Undersecretary of the Pontifical Council for Promoting New Evangelization, Monsignor Graham Bell. He speaks to me about the Year of Faith shortly after the project was launched in the Vatican's press office on Thursday, 21st of June. Also presented on this occasion were the website www.annusfidei.va, the logo and the official hymn, which goes by the title of Credo Domine Adoage Nobis Fidem, relating to this special year. A year called for by Benedict XVI in an effort to mark in a special way both the 50th anniversary of the opening session of the Second Vatican Council on the 11th of October 1962, as well as the 20th anniversary of the presentation of the Catechism of the Catholic Church. Before we listen to Monsignor Bell, I thought I'd give you some background about this Year of Faith. It was first announced by the Pope on the 17th of October 2011, when he issued the apostolic letter Porta Fidei, or Door of Faith, in which he writes,
"Faith grows when it's lived as an experience of love received, and when it's communicated as an experience of grace and joy."
Going on to explain how the main focus of this year will be on the figure of Jesus Christ. The Holy Father has expressed the hope the occasion might provide
renewed energy to the mission of the whole Church to lead men and women out of the desert they often are in and toward the place of life friendship with Christ, who gives us fullness of life.
What I'd like to do now is bring you another excerpt from Porta Fidei. It's read for us, as were the first two quotes, by Sean Patrick Lovett.
It seemed to me that timing the launch of the Year of Faith to coincide with the 50th anniversary of the opening of the Second Vatican Council would provide a good opportunity to help people understand that the texts bequeathed by the Council Fathers, in the words of Blessed John Paul II, have lost nothing of their value or brilliance. They need to be read correctly, to be widely known and taken to heart as important and normative texts of the Magisterium within the Church's tradition. I feel more than ever in duty bound to point to the Council as the great grace bestowed on the Church in the 20th century. There we find a sure compass by which to take our bearings in the century now beginning. I would also like to emphasize strongly that I had occasion to say concerning the Council a few months after my election as successor of Peter, if we interpret and implement it, guided by a right hermeneutic, it can be and become increasingly powerful for the ever-necessary renewal of the Church.
Having listened to the Pope's words there, it's time to join Monsignor Graham Bell, who was kind enough to come to our studios here at Vatican Radio. I began by asking him a question relating precisely to the continuation with Vatican II.
The opening coincides with the 50th anniversary of the opening of the Council in 1962, and also it coincides with the 20th anniversary of the promulgation of the Catechism of the Catholic Church. And the Catechism of the Catholic Church is really one of the most important fruits of the Second Vatican Council. Anyone who takes up a copy of the Catechism cannot fail to be struck by the fact that the Catechism continually quotes the 16 documents of the Council. If we could put it this way, the Catechism is in many ways the Council explained to the Church. In the light of the experience which the Church has made in the 50 years since the opening of the Council.
So it's a statement that the texts have not lost anything of their value and brilliance, as John Paul II said.
As we go further ahead into history, the importance of the Council and the intention of Popes John the 23rd, Paul the 6th, their intentions in promulgating the documents become clearer.
This year of faith, would you say it's a call for a spiritual awakening, which is timed at a moment in history when there's a crisis of faith?
I don't think anyone can deny that, especially in the West, there is a crisis of faith. And the Holy Father has called this year of faith so that everyone in the Church can renew their personal relationship with Jesus Christ, because faith is born of that. Faith is our response, our graced response to God's revelation in Jesus Christ. And Jesus Christ is the fullness of God's revelation. And all of us during the year of faith are called to renew our personal relationship with him. Christianity is a very special religion. It's the only religion in which God became man. It's not a religion of the book. It's a religion of the person. It's a religion of the person of Jesus Christ. And we are all, as Christians, followers of Jesus Christ. And there's a question which every Christian has to ask himself or herself every now and again, and it's the following. Not just what do I believe, why do I believe? Why do I believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God made man, and what does that mean for my life?
At what level is this year of faith pitched then? Is it personal or communitarian?
I think it's both, of course, because the faith is personal and communitarian. The faith is a personal act. All of us believe as individuals. But faith also has a community dimension, because we can only believe in the Church, because we receive the faith from the Church, which is the mediation of God's revelation in history, and we are called to profess our faith in the Church.
This year of faith begins during the special synod,
yes,
which focuses on new evangelization.
Yes.
And your council is to promote new evangelization.
Yes.
Where's the link between new evangelization and the year of faith?
When we speak about new evangelization, we have to clarify what we mean by the adjective new. Obviously, it's not new to the extent that it adds anything to the gospel, because we received the gospel from Jesus Christ through the apostles, and it will be the same gospel until the end of time. The gospel doesn't change. What does change is the circumstances in which the Church announces the gospel. And in the world of today, we have to be very, very careful about a number of factors which intervene in our preaching of the gospel. We have to be very careful about the cultural context in which modern men and women live. We have to be very, very aware of the new technologies which are available in announcing the gospel. We also have to be very, very aware of those situations in which it can be very, very difficult to believe. We live in a society which is under the domination of science and technology. Those two things can often make it seem very, very difficult to believe. And so the Church is called today to affront new situations, to face up to new situations, and to give new answers to the perennial question which every man and woman has as they seek after the sense of their own personal existence.
So it won't be an occasion to draw from the expression of popular piety then?
I think popular piety is very, very important, because popular piety, apart from the fact it has a very, very long and illustrious tradition in the history of the Church, but I think it's a richness for the Church, because there are an infinite variety of paths to God and to Jesus Christ. And the variety in the Church of personal piety is an expression of this. And I think it's very, very important that we allow people to reach Christ at their level. You know, in this, personal piety can be very, very important, because, as I said, there are an infinite variety of ways to God. And personal piety puts at the centre the personal relationship between the believer and Jesus Christ. So, of course, it's something which has to be purified, it's something which has to be explained, and has to become the basis for a catechesis.
On a more practical level, the year launched already has a calendar of events.
Yes.
Can you share with us some of the highlights?
I'll tell you what for me is one of the most interesting of the events, and it will take place on the Sunday of Corpus Christi in 2013. The date is precisely the 2nd of June. The Holy Father will preside over an hour of Eucharistic adoration in the Vatican. And what we are asking for is, at exactly the same time, throughout all the world, that in the cathedrals and in parish churches, if that's possible, that the bishops, together with their priests and people, can at the same time carry out an hour of Eucharistic adoration in communion with the Holy Father.
And while my thanks there go to the Undersecretary of the Pontifical Council for promoting new evangelisation, Monsignor Graham Bell, I'd now like to read once again from Porta Fide, because, as I discovered, the last such event was launched by Paul VI almost half a century ago. But why don't I bring you a reading from Pope Benedict's Porta Fide once again.
Paul VI announced one in 1967 to commemorate the martyrdom of Saints Peter and Paul on the 19th centenary of their supreme act of witness. He thought of it as a solemn moment for the whole Church to make an authentic and sincere profession of the same faith. Moreover, he wanted this to be confirmed in a way that was individual and collective, free and conscious, inward and outward, humble and frank. He thought that in this way, the whole Church could reappropriate exact knowledge of the faith so as to reinvigorate it, purify it, confirm it, and confess it. The great upheavals of that year made even more evident the need for a celebration of this kind. It concluded with the Credo of the People of God, intended to show how much the essential content that for centuries has formed the heritage of all believers needs to be confirmed, understood, and explored ever anew, so as to bear constant witness in historical circumstances very different from those of the past.
Well, thank you so much for listening to this programme I put together for you, focusing on the Year of Faith. Now let's join our favourite parish priest and long-time friend of ours here at Vatican Radio, Monsignor Peter Fleetwood of the Liverpool Archdiocese. His parish is St Joseph's Blundellstands, lies in the area of England which has the densest Catholic population. He helps us better understand the term new evangelisation and what that might entail at a parish level. People in general are a bit mystified by the term new evangelisation.
Well, if you spoke Latin fluently every day, or if you spoke German fluently every day, you'd know exactly what it means. Neue Evangelisierung in German would be evangelising afresh or evangelising again. And it's the same idea in Latin. It's not a completely new thing. It's doing the job again. But the new thing is maybe that you find new methods or new ways of communicating. So it's not a new content. The message is very important, and that's why we are still Catholics. That's why we remain committed to the Church and the Gospel and the person of Jesus. And those things have to be central in whatever is new. You don't lose those things, but that you think, well, how can I tell more people about this? Or how can I tell the people who don't feel worthy to be in church that, you know, that's just the wrong idea? You know, the Church is for you. I'm not worthy to celebrate Mass, I never will be. But I do it because I'm invited to, and it's a great privilege to me, and I know it's a strength to lots of people.
I don't live in your part of the world, but, for example, here in Rome, you get the feeling that there are a lot of nominal Catholics who go to church when they prepare for their first communion, they have their first communion, they get confirmed, they get married, and then when they die, there's a Catholic funeral. But it doesn't really go beyond that.
Yeah, I don't think that's new to anybody in any part of the world. There's nowhere that is without that phenomenon of very superficial adherence to the Church. Some people don't know what it is to be deeply committed, but maybe that's exactly the challenge. We're trying in Liverpool a different way of approaching the sacraments. Previously, people my age, for example, learned most of what we learned in school. And whether that coincided with our home life was a lottery. I was lucky, at least my parents believed in it, although they didn't go to church very much. And my grandmother was at home, and she was a profoundly Christian woman, possibly even a mystic, but I was lucky. There were many people in my class whose parents obviously didn't know which end of the church was which when they came for communion or confirmation or any of those sacraments. So now the Archbishop has decided that all catechesis or preparation for the sacraments will be done with the help of the members of the family, which means a bit of a revolution and an upheaval for all the kind people who've given so many hours and years as catechists. They've got to find a new way of being not so much teachers of content, but helpful to parents in the sense of accompanying them as they, the parents, pass on what they know and maybe feed the parents a bit more so that they know more. In the process, everybody learns. It's quite remarkable when it's done properly. But we priests and our catechists who work with us are finding it a great challenge to change the way we do things. But it's obviously the best way forward, because that way the parents don't just turn up on the day of the celebration. They're very much part of it all from the beginning. Whether it continues after that is up to them. Nobody can be forced to do anything, and that's not the idea. But it may just chip away at the superficiality of some people's commitment and help others to deepen theirs.
You mentioned that your grandmother was a Christian, rather than saying she was a Catholic. Why did you say that?
To me, the two things aren't really very different. But as a matter of fact, she was a convert from Anglicanism. And by being converted, she was disinherited and disowned by her family. So she never saw them again, ever. She gave up everything to become a Catholic and to marry the man she met in later when she moved to Ireland. So her telling of the Catholic story was remarkable. She told me of the place she went to learn about the Catholic faith, which was somewhere near Preston, a little place called Gregson Lane. She told me of some of the experience she had of the presence of God and even the presence of the devil. And she was a remarkable lady. When she prayed, it was quite an experience to be with her. And she's the one who took me to church. She's the one who taught me that you can't really hate. It's not part of us. All these things would need explaining at great length, but all this to say she was a powerful spirit and a great influence on me, and I suspect on all her own children, two of whom went off to be religious brothers, but didn't stay. But that's quite something out of six children. Then eventually I went off to try to be a priest, but she'd long died by then. But she's probably one of the main influences. But having been an Anglican, she was also very sympathetic to his thirst for the gospel in other ways of being Christians. So maybe it was the right word to choose. She was never closed to other forms of Christianity, but well aware of the difficulties we had as Catholics in Liverpool in those days. It wasn't easy to live alongside some people who didn't share our way of worshipping and were very violent in the way they expressed that to us.
Finding new ways to evangelise is something that's necessary, it's something that's needed, because earlier on you said there was a crisis of faith, I think, if I understood correctly, and that it's going to get worse.
I don't think I said there was a crisis of faith, but there may be one. What I was talking about was simply a crisis in the numbers of people attending church or practising their religion. That's getting difficult. It's very funny when people want us to maintain the same level of service in terms of the number of masses we say, when there are far fewer priests, but much more important, far fewer people going to mass.
But surely that reflects a crisis of faith, doesn't it? The fact that people are not going to church.
Could do. I can't judge that unless I speak to the individuals. I think sometimes it's just a habit, a laziness, rather than a crisis of what they believe in. They just don't bother anymore, many of them. And many people are under pressure to do other things. If you have a healthy young boy in your family, it's quite likely that on a Sunday morning he'll be required to play football or be in an athletics team or play cricket at certain times of the year, or judo or whatever. It's very hard for a parent to say, you can't do that, you've got to go to church. Some people manage to do it, I think a lot of people say, no, that's part of his upbringing as well. That's part of what we want for him. So a lot of families now find it very hard to fit in the demands of all their children's lives and church. So I don't think it's a crisis of faith so much as an inability or an impossibility of organising things in a way that includes everything. Another thing is, I made a big mistake many years ago by believing it was a good thing for shops to be open on Sundays. I realised a few years ago that I'd made a dreadful error of judgment. Sunday is not special really anymore in our culture, and one of the sad byproducts that I remember being told about in those days, and it didn't hit me until I saw the effects of it, is the number of people who would lose their job if they refused to work on a Sunday. So they can't go to church unless they happen to find a mass at some unearthly hour on a Saturday evening or a Sunday evening. But that takes commitment, a special kind of strength, almost physical strength, to be able to work all day and go to church at night. Some people do it. All I'm thinking of is it's not always a crisis of faith that keeps people away from church. It's very often very difficult circumstances in their lives. I'm the last person to blame people for not coming to church, but I have to recognise how many are there in order to know how many masses I need to have in my parish or in my deanery. Or, you know, we're just being realistic at the moment in terms of reorganisation. But the older people find that incredibly hard. And yet the real thrust, as in the parable of the Good Shepherd, is not to look after the 99 who are safe, but to go after the one who's lost. And believe me, older parishioners who notice that you're going off looking for new people to come to church or trying to attract more to church, sometimes they take that as an insult. But we're here. You don't thank us for being here. Well, we can't win on that one. But the new evangelization is the action of the Good Shepherd, who's recognised that some of the sheep have wandered off, and all it would take would be an invitation or a stratagem to invite them back in a convincing way. The new evangelisation isn't telling them anything new. It's just saying, why aren't those people here? Or even, I'm here, but is my faith deep enough? Do I need to relearn my faith? Do we as a parish need to relearn things, to redo things, to reorganise things? There's all sorts of aspects of this new evangelisation when you think about it.
And you were listening there to Monsignor Peter Fleetwood, a parish priest from the Liverpool Archdiocese in England. Finally, why not join Monsignor Philip Whitmore as he brings us a musical meditation by the title of Hear Thy Children.
Have you ever suffered from a thing called writer's block? You've got a deadline for something you're meant to be writing. You sit at your desk and nothing comes. You stare at a blank piece of paper or an empty computer screen and you wonder how you're ever going to get started. It happens to composers too, and it often happened to that great English composer Sir Edward Elgar, especially towards the end of his life. When he was quite an old man, in 1931, someone made a really good suggestion. Why don't you compose something using odd bits of music you wrote when you were young? Ideas you never really developed at the time. Elgar gave it a try, and the result was his nursery suite, dedicated to two young princesses, Elizabeth and Margaret, and their mother. Elgar jotted down a few notes about each movement in the suite. The first one, he said, should call up memories of happy and peaceful awakenings. The music flows in a serene way. A fragment of a hymn tune is introduced, a hymn written for little children when the composer was a youth. Elgar was about 21 when he wrote this hymn tune back in 1878. He probably wrote it for St. George's Catholic Church in Worcester, where his father was organist at the time, and where he himself became organist 7 years later. It was during this part of his life that he wrote some lovely small-scale church music that can easily be sung by parish choirs today. Some of you may know his fine setting of the Ave Verum Corpus, written in 1887. To go back to that hymn tune which the old man recalled from his youth, you remember he said he'd written it for children. And true enough, the words are an evening hymn written for children by Francis Stanfield. Hear thy children, gentle Jesus, while we breathe our evening prayer. Save us from all harm and danger. Take us neath thy sheltering care. Don't believe anyone who tells you children don't like singing quality music. But it's true that it takes a special gift to write well for children. Elgar certainly had it. Even as an old man, the idea of composing a children's piece, using fragments he'd jotted down over 50 years earlier, gave him a new inspiration. The first movement of the nursery suite is about waking up in the morning. The hymn tune comes in quietly at first, then towards the end it's repeated more loudly and it dies away to a peaceful close. The day has begun.
And warm thanks there go to Monsignor Philip Whittemore, a music historian who's currently working as an official at the Vatican's Secretariat of State. That brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Don't forget, we'll be back again at the same time tomorrow, so be sure to join us then. Laudetur Jesus Christus.